From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Updike's novels have chronicled the changes in middle-class marriage and family life. On today's Fresh Air, Updike talks about why he's found domestic life to be such fertile territory. His new novel is set in the future, but in many ways, it's a novel about aging. We'll hear an onstage interview I recorded with Updike last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new tribute album to Jimmy Rogers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House is prepared to release another batch of videotapes of President Clinton at more than 100 different events. Some of these tapes show him having coffee with donors at the White House. The latest release comes at about the same time that Attorney General Janet Reno is expected to announce that she needs more time to decide if there's enough evidence in the White House fundraising flap to call for a special prosecutor. She has until tomorrow to decide whether to extend her current initial inquiry to the next stage, which is a preliminary investigation. Officials say she wants to make the decision before tomorrow morning's appearance before the House Judiciary Committee. Two Americans have won this year's Nobel Prize for Economics. One of the laureates is a professor at Harvard Business School. Mark Deegan of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
Robert Merton of Harvard University and Myron Scholes of Stanford University are cited for groundbreaking work on stock options. Merton says he never expected the honor, even though a formula he and Scholes developed in the 1970s is now used widely by traders and investors.
It allows professionals to be able to price and hedge a very wide range of very complex types of securities, many of which impact people in various parts of the world every day.
This year's Nobel Prize in Economics, to be presented in December, is worth $1 million. Merton says he has no idea how he and Scholes will use the money. For NPR News, I'm Mark Deegan in Boston.
Civilians are fleeing from renewed fighting in the Congolese capital, Brazzaville. They're escaping by canoe across the Congo River toward Kinshasa. Troops loyal to the former military leader, Denis Sassou Nguesso, reportedly have been attacking the presidential palace and are claiming control. The BBC's William Wallace is in neighboring Kinshasa.
Well, I'm standing in a tower looking over the River Congo, and I can still see pirogues, canoes crossing over. There are dramatic scenes on the other side in Brazzaville where there are dozens of people queuing up to get on just a number of small pirogues to try and escape to the relative safety of Kinshasa. The latest I've heard from the military commanders of General Sassou's forces is that they have now taken the presidency.
The BBC's William Wallace in Kinshasa. Scientists and weather forecasters are meeting in Santa Monica, California, to discuss the weather phenomenon called El Niño. The conference has already drawn emergency officials from all levels of government and Vice President Al Gore. El Niño has brought unusually warm weather to California, and forecasters warn this could lead to a wet winter. Experts have already started to advise Californians to stock up on batteries, and homeowners are being told to repair their roofs. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 8.5 points at 8,081. Trading is moderate. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed at this hour. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner has details from New York.
Investors are taking encouragement from a list of better-than-expected earnings reports. General Motors, Texas Instruments, Eastman Kodak, Nations Bank, and Merrill Lynch were among the companies whose profits surpassed forecast. The market is also being supported by strength in Treasury bond prices, which occurred after Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan failed to signal any change in U.S. interest rate policy during an appearance this morning at the Cato Institute in Washington. Bond prices got an additional boost when the Federal Reserve bought Treasury securities on the open market in an operation known as a coupon pass. I'm Doug Krisner.
Two computer technology firms are teaming up to let millions of Internet users exchange messages instantly. America Online and Netscape Communications have reached agreement to bring AOL's instant message service to the Internet. This feature has been available to AOL users only up until now. America Online says the instant message is like a phone call because users can talk in real time by typing. Now, people using Netscape Navigator will be able to do the same. The service is to be built into Netscape's new worldwide web browser that's due out in about a month. Toyota has introduced the first car that uses both gas and electricity. The automaker says the Prius is a cleaner-burning car and gets better mileage than cars that use gas alone. This new car doesn't need to be recharged because the engine and the brakes do that instead of a charging station. Most automakers have been working on a hybrid car, but Toyota's is the first to reach the market. However, right now it's only being sold in Japan. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've had the pleasure of interviewing John Updike several times. Today we're going to listen to an on-stage interview recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of their series Rebuilding the Future. The first time I interviewed John Updike, in 1988, he said, "I think people look to writers to tell the truth in a way that nobody else quite will, not politicians or ministers or sociologists. A writer's job is to, by way of fiction, somehow describe the way we live." Updike has clarified our lives for us through his fiction, and his literary criticism has helped us find the truth, or the lack of it, in the work of other writers. Updike has won all of America's major literary prizes, including two Pulitzers, the American Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. He once said that his subject is the American Protestant small-town middle class. He chronicled small-town middle-class life in his Rabbit trilogy, but he's also written novels set in faraway places and set in the past. His new novel, Toward the End of Time, is set in the future, in the year 2020, after a recent war between the U.S. and China. The main character, Ben Turnbull, has just turned 66. In fact, in spite of the futuristic setting, I think this is really a novel about aging. I asked Updike if, in a way, it's been interesting to age because it offers new territory to write about.
It's true. Every day you're older than you've ever been before. And in a sense, you are blazing a trail, really, and sending back news to the younger of what it's like, others have gone before you, and the older I get, the more I think of my parents. My father lived to be 72, and my mother to quite a good age, 85, although that was not as old as her father had lived. He lived with us, or we lived with him, and he lived to be 90. So I'm aware of aging, but don't do it in the I do it in a kind of a hopeful spirit because with any kind of luck, I have fairly long-lived genes and see this as a territory with some advantages. It's certainly more peaceful than your middle years, and certainly your sense of yourself is more solid than it was when you were an adolescent. Many of the questions you ask of life have been answered. It's a nice time to try to appreciate the weather, the stars, and the things that come up in toward the end of time.
Are there things that you feel haven't been said about aging that you are trying to explore now in your writing?
One's witness is individual, and in a way I've had a unique take on all these life stages from childhood on. I don't know as I have any special news about aging. America and the world are being old. Getting old is more and more the usual thing. An old person used to be a survivor and was kind of heroic for having survived. And in Africa and China, they would look to their old people for wisdom because they really to have lived a long time was a great accomplishment. It's not so great for 20th century American. You tend to, instead of playing less, you tend to play more. I know that my contemporaries, as they one by one retire, have ever more time to play. I'm invited to join in this kind of return of childhood. I'm still trying to work being a self-employed writer. There's nobody to tell you to retire, so you go on until you drop, basically. No, I don't know what I have to say. In this book, what do I say about aging? I say that the sex instinct does not die, that it remains, inconvenient as it sometimes is. And this fellow, this hero of mine, who is not exactly me and does not entirely express my views, is kind of tough. Tough in a way that maybe only the old can be, because they've seen a lot and in a way have less stake in the global game than the young.
In Ipswich, which was the first place that you lived in New England, you said, "My impersonation of a normal person in Ipswich became as good as I could make it." You were impersonating a normal person? You didn't feel like a normal person there? And if you were impersonating a normal person, who were you really?
I never felt quite normal. It always seemed to me that other people knew more than I did and were possibly having more fun. I was an only child, so I was denied the companionship and the life lessons that siblings give one. I lived with four older people, my mother's parents and my own parents. I had several afflictions which, while not fatal, served to intensify my sense of being a boy apart. I stammered a certain amount, not so much that I didn't keep trying to get the word out, but enough to annoy me and probably annoy those around me. I had a skin condition which, although none fatal and none painful, in season could be and was humiliating. Then added to this wish to be a writer, and this wish to write, very unusual in small town Pennsylvania. We did know that writers existed. and there was even a live writer in the area. Mildred, some of the older people among the audience may remember Mildred Jordan, whose One Red Rose Forever about Baron von Stiegel was a sort of bestseller for a while. She lived in Reading, though, and was really out of the ken of little middle-class boys like me. We didn't know in the 40s that Reading had produced one of America's greatest poets, Wallace Stevens. We only knew that Judge Stevens, his brother, sat on the bench in Reading and was frequently in the headlines. So anyway, to think of being a writer was a very odd idea, which wouldn't have occurred to me, but it had occurred to my mother. And she was the real person in the family called to write. She was the one who I watched tap away at her typewriter in Shillington and then in Plowville, where we moved. She was the one who kept at it and implanted in me something of a ambition. Anyway, by the time I got to Ipswich, I was a published writer in the New Yorker. I appeared fairly frequently, poems and short stories. I'd been a talk of the town writer, and in Ipswich too, writers weren't common. So in that sense, I was, yes, one of a kind.
Well, while you were writing about the middle class went crazy. I mean, this was the period when marriages were breaking up. People in the middle class, who in another era might have had a very stable nuclear family, they were doing drugs and drinking a lot, and not all of them, but some of them, and some of them whom you wrote about. Marriages were breaking up, new relationships were forming, there were affairs on the side. Was this a very interesting time to be writing about the middle class?
It turned out to be. I didn't plan these events. I was like many in the 50s. I married young. It was really the most feasible way of getting a woman to go to bed with you was to marry her. And the Eisenhower, what is the word? Not mystique, but the
The mood was certainly to create little nuclear households of happy children and humming appliances and a collie dog in the station wagon. And I acquired all that, and even not the collie, but it was a golden retriever, which seemed close enough. And then, as Terry says, the revolution of the 60s, that world really came apart, not in 1960, but in 1963, when we woke up and were told that John Kennedy, or didn't wake up, we learned it in the middle of the day, when John Kennedy was shot somehow, that let loose a lot of demons, and the discontent that the 50s conformity had imperfectly masked really let loose. We were a little old for the revolution by this time. We were parents of small children, four in my case. Four was not uncommon in that generation. Four or five were sort of the standard family. And I suppose there was a general wish to join in the fun. So we had our own little sexual revolution, a suburban sexual revolution. Which, as Terry says, took the unhappy form of divorce often. Very few of those 50s marriages survived. Doesn't mean it was a bad idea. Most of those people have married again, so it wasn't marriage that they were against. It was just maybe enough marriage to that particular person. But yes, I wrote Couples, basically, trying to describe this phenomenon of a generation for which the various faiths, patriotic and religious, had faded, and for whom, unlike today, to whom their professions offered no real deep diversion. The men went and did jobs, but they only worked 9 to 5. There wasn't this passionate fright to work endless hours that there is now. Jobs were by no means as consuming. You kind of did them on the side, almost like your private functions. One of them was to have a job. But your real life was the social life, was the parties where you'd take your wife and look at the other wives. I mean, it was a world in which, as my theory was at the time, people tried, in the absence of another compelling religion, to make a religion of each other, a kind of a cult intermingling. It was the heyday of the Julia Child dinner party. It was the heyday of the Sunday afternoon volleyball game. It was a lot of rubbing elbows, my father used to call it.
Now, Rabbit, the first Rabbit novel was published, I think, in 1960, about 3 years after Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Now, in the beginning of the Rabbit novel, Rabbit leaves his wife. He's really restless. He's really unhappy, frustrated. And he takes off in his car, and he drives south. He has no idea where the hell he's going. And so he can't tell if he's gotten there yet, because he has no destination. And he ends up just turning around and going back home. It's a really interesting counterpoint to On the Road, which is about the fun and the adventure and the excitement of being on the road. This was about the not being able to go anyplace, not being able to really get away. And I'm wondering if you ever felt that you were missing out on this adventure that other people and your other writers of your generation were having, the sense that the road is filled with mystical adventures and lots of sex and drugs and freedom and exciting things to write about. And at the same time, too, they were writing about the stuff in this kind of jazz improvisation kind of way. And you were creating this beautifully crafted, intricate prose, also a direct counterpoint to what the beat writers of your generation were doing.
They didn't feel like my generation. They felt like a slightly older generation. I was sort of jealous of Kerouac. I did think he was having more fun than I. And I resented the book to the extent that I didn't read it for years after it came out. But my Pennsylvania small town farm boy mentality argued against this vision of being on the road. It seemed to me we couldn't all be on the road all the time. Nothing would get done. And the reality surely was is that we are all a party, one way or another to a social contract, and when one unit in the social web takes off, there are tugs and breaks he leaves behind him, so that Rabbit Run was, in some sense, a kind of an ante on the road. Yes, he breaks away, and there is that within us which cries out for freedom, more freedom, utter freedom, which rebels against the constraints. Rabbit is faced with a alcoholic and pregnant wife, and a dead-end job of no great charm, a glorious past as a high school athletic hero, and a general sense of being caught. He is a caught rabbit, a rabbit in a trap. So he, yes, breaks out, but then I thought it was more realistic to think that such a person would then have nowhere to go, get lost on the road after the one glorious burst of freedom, and return to where he came from, which is what he does. Anyway, that was my take on the road and similar philosophy.
And did you worry that hipsters are going to think I'm square?
Hipsters would think that I'm square. I'm square. I suppose being square didn't frighten me too much. To me, the act of creating poems and stories that got into print was so otherworldly to me that I didn't imagine that. No, I thought I was the opposite of square. I was cool, and it was cool to get into print. It was cool to try to perceive a pattern, to make tales out of this grayish middle class amorphous stretch around one. So I was a happy man.
We're listening to an onstage interview with John Updike, recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to my interview with John Updike, recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia. You write in your memoir, "My success was based, I felt, on a certain calculated modesty, on my cultivated fondness for exploring corners, the space beneath the Shillington dining table, where the nap of the rug was still thick, the back stairs where the vacuum cleaner and rubber galoshes lived. I had left the heavily trafficked literary turfs to others, and stayed in my corner of New England to give its domestic news." Now, it occurs to me that domestic news has traditionally been the territory of women writers, whereas men traditionally wrote more about, like you were saying, adventure, war, the big issues of the day, politics, or you know whatever. Do you feel that you brought a kind of male point of view to a territory that had, for the most part, previously been women's territory in fiction?
That hadn't especially occurred to me. My concrete objective was to get enough stories in the New Yorker that I could support my own domestic scene, which rapidly, as I said, became four children. And the New Yorker ran almost entirely stories about domestic situations. Sean, who was then editor, had an aversion, personal aversion, toward violence. You never saw what would pass for an adventure story in the New Yorker. So I was just really one of the crowd. I mean, Cheever was also writing about domestic situations, and in some way, the home, the American home, was where it was at in those years, so that you didn't feel you were cultivating a backwater. I didn't. I thought that this was everybody, more or less, except for Jack Kerouac, was, and he, funnily enough, I happened to know a little about Kerouac because he came from Lowell, fairly near to where I live, and he kept coming back to his mother. So Neil Cassidy and Ginsberg were fine for a while, but he'd come back to Mama Kerouac and eat her home cooking for months at a time. So much for you, Jack Kerouac.
In writing about domestic life, you of course also wrote about sex, which is an important part of married life and domestic life. And now I have to quote Nicholson Baker, and if you haven't read his book, You and I, the you being for Updike and the I being for Nicholson Baker, read it. It's a memoir about Nicholson Baker's obsessive relationship as a reader and as a writer with John Updike. Nicholson Baker writes, Updike was the first to take the penile sensorium under the wing of elaborate metaphorical prose. And he says, Updike brought a serious, morally sensitive, National Book Award-winning prose style to bear on the micromechanics of physical lovemaking. What do you think of that?
Micromechanics. They don't feel micro when you're when you're doing it.
This idea of the National Book Award-winning literary style applied to lovemaking.
It's a very jaunty piece of criticism, and not untrue. But I saw it. I would have seen it in slightly grander terms. Seemed to me important in writing about people to be able to try to describe the sexual transactions between them. For many people, it's the height of what they see of ecstasy in poetry is in their sexual encounters. And furthermore, personality, human personality, does not end in the bedroom, but persists. Not all lovemaking is alike. Anyway, it seemed a writer should clearly be free to describe it. And one didn't entirely lack models for sexual realism, even in the late 50s and early 60s. There was Joyce's, James Joyce's, Molly Bloom's soliloquy and earlier passages in which the sex quite explicitly but is rolled into the general continuum of her awareness. It's really a beautiful example of lots of sex, but probably not more sex than there really is. It's by no means pornographic, but just isolates the sex. But in Molly Bloom, you get a feeling of the sexual basis of our existence. D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover was certainly around, first as a rumor and then as an actual book, which which we could read. Certain 18th century fiction writers described things more or less as they were, somebody like a book like Moll Flanders. So, you know, one wasn't entirely new in this. What may have been new and what Baker highlights is that my prose style was heavily influenced by Proust, who I read in my early 20s, and maybe I did try to bring to certain couplings a Proustian eloquence, just as I would bring that same eloquence to anything I was describing.
John Updike recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We'll hear more of that interview in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Updike reads from a mystery story he wrote when he was 14 as we continue our onstage interview. And Ken Tucker reviews the new Jimmy Rogers tribute album.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of an onstage interview with John Updike, recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Updike has a new novel called Toward the End of Time. Although it's set in the future, it is in many ways a novel about aging and about the impact of aging on the main character's sex life. Updike has often written about sexuality in his fiction.
You've described yourself as shy and priggish as a young man. Was it hard being shy to write pretty sexually explicit material?
No, it's just what a shy and priggish person would do. writing is a kind of act of aggression, and a person who is not aggressive in his normal, may I say, intercourse with humanity might well be an aggressive writer. I felt I couldn't have done it, but I had the courage of my convictions, and the convictions was that this was worth doing, and that it certainly existed, and that after Freud, no one needed argue the importance of sex in our lives.
Just one other question on this. Do you find that some people have misinterpreted the sexual aspects of your writing?
No. Some have complained about it, but I don't think anybody misread it, or maybe they did. I don't know. You can't keep track of the misreadings. It was said early and late that there was too much of it, but it didn't seem like to be too much to me. Rabbit Run, I was so alarming, this is in 1959, was so alarming to the readers at the publishing house that Alfred Knopf, who was then very much in charge of the house, he liked the book but had lawyers read it. The lawyers said, this won't do, you'll be put in jail by Southern sheriffs. How Southern sheriffs would have gotten to Alfred Knopf, I don't know, but I was then 26, and this is my second novel, and I was pleased he liked it, and displeased that there was this shadow over it. And also, once he'd called in the lawyers, this will interest the lawyers among you. Maybe you're all lawyers. Philadelphia lawyers. That once you've asked for legal advice and you don't take it, you're in worse shape than if you hadn't asked at all. So by having asked and received an answer, he had, in a sense, committed himself either to refuse the book or have some trimming done. I liked Alfred, and I liked the house. I liked the way the books looked and didn't think I'd get a better deal necessarily anywhere else. So I did consent to do a little legal trimming, done very tastefully, I thought, and delicately by a young man. He and I sat elbow to elbow in this funny room, taking out certain words. He didn't want contact. He didn't mind the words so much. He just didn't want to see the people rubbing against each other. And so the text, somewhat modified, came out. The English publisher would not publish it, even though it had been modified. He wouldn't even print Alfred's version, so we did change English publishers, but went ahead with the American, and of course, it was on the cusp of the revolution. You had Lolita coming out, and you had the Tropics books in the pipeline, Lady Chatterley. So in the end, it was nothing, and no Southern sheriff even threatened to put either of us in jail. So in a way, it was all kind of wasted effort. But it was, anyway, to make a long story short, those passages where Rabbit and Ruth explore each other, discover each other, whatever, were very crucial, I thought, to a book about a man's quest. Certainly here was the peak of a certain kind of quest, and as far as ecstasy and purity and light, he wasn't going to find it much of anywhere else, so I thought it was very worth trying to describe that.
I think you were 14 when you wrote your first short story, which is reprinted in a book called First Words, Earliest Writing from Favorite Contemporary Authors. And I'd actually like to have you read the first couple of paragraphs from this story that you wrote when you were 14.
This was a funny project that some pair of, I guess a single professor with nothing better to do got together. And so a lot of us, and the first words, surviving words of mine that I could find were in this mystery novel, which I tried to write, I believe in 1946 when I was 14. As I already told you, I did used to read a lot of mystery novels. So I kind of knew how they went. This begins, "My employer, Manuel Citaro, pushed the letter across the desk at me. It was written in a large, masculine hand with no curlicues and a firm downstroke." My mother, I should interpose here, was an amateur graphologist. She had a book called Graphology in the house, so I was made handwriting conscious very early in life. Your entire character can be read off from your handwriting. This letter had no curlicues and a firm downstroke. "Mr. Citaro," it read, "I would like your presence over the weekend at my country home, Whitehaven. There will be three other guests beside yourself. The visit may have some interest professionally to you. Let me know if you can come. Signed, Walter Haldeman." "Doesn't waste ink, does he?" I remarked. "That is what makes it so interesting," Manuel replied. Obviously, he's a foreigner, like Hercule Poirot is a foreigner, with a very charming accent that David Suchet could do. "That is what makes it so interesting," Manuel replied. "It is more like a command than an invitation. Not one please in the entire letter. The interest professionally sentence is indeed fascinating," spelled F-A-S-C-E-N-A-T-I-N-G. "Sentence is indeed fascinating. It might mean anything. His wife might be unfaithful. His butler might be a pilferer. His dog might have fits. Or his life may be in danger." I chuckled. "Probably one of the first three. A big man like Walt Haldeman imagines he has to have the best of everything for anything, no matter how trifling. He probably calls in Adrienne when his little girl wants a new doll dress made. He doesn't have a little girl, and I disagree with you. I sense something big, important here, regardless of his vague phraseology. Surely you're not going." "I am." Exciting.
I think that's pretty darn good for a 14-year-old. Nevertheless, I'd like you to edit it for us. What's your quick critique of that?
Well, it's not bad. It gets the action going pretty well. I would try to clean up the spelling. I don't see much to improve. I never have been able to write a mystery novel through. This is but the first of many aborted attempts. I think I stuck with this one longer than many. I worked at it the whole, at least a month of that. Very hard to write in Pennsylvania in the summer. You may have noticed it's very muggy, and your hand sticks to the paper, and the typewriter keys stick. But I carried this to about 40 pages, and it shows in this young man at least some notion of suspense. That is, you have to, with the very first sentence, in some way, get something going that makes the hypothetical reader want to turn the page or see what happens next. And that's a lesson that my mother's attempts to be a writer, and she took lessons by mail of how to be a writer. All that was in some way bore meager fruit here, but it's something that stayed with me always, that the writer owes the reader something, as well as the reader owing the writer some attention and patience and empathy that the writer has to provide some reason to keep reading.
I was really so impressed about that line about the firm downstroke and the penmanship, and I thought, this is like fantastic detail for a 14-year-old to be bringing into fiction. I didn't realize your mother was an amateur graphologist. But I think there's a lesson in this. It is like the more you know, the more interesting detail you can put in fiction.
And fiction is very greedy, too. It'll take all you know and then some. Especially first novel I tried to write through, I was struck by this, that the appetite of the blank page for ever more information, ever more data. An empty book is a greedy a greedy thing. And you're right, you wind up using everything you know, and often more than once.
John Updike answers some questions from the audience after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to John Updike, recorded at the Free Library of Philadelphia last month. We'll hear a few of the questions asked by members of the audience.
Mr. Updike, I'd like to ask you if you think The New Yorker is now going forward with your talents and others to its past greatness.
Do I think it's going forward to its past greatness? I think that's sort of the idea, certainly. I think it's changing. The New Yorker always did change. If you look at the issues in the 30s, they look quite other than the issues of the 50s. But the changes have never been so noticeable as they have under Tina Brown, who was brought in, after all, to change it. The New Yorker, as it was going, was a very estimable magazine, dearly loved by those of us who loved it, but we were getting older and dying off, and something had to be done, and she's tried to make it more accessible. Favorite word of editors now, accessible to younger readers, shortened it up, sort of goosed it up. I think the magazine honestly reflects her own interests. She is interested in politics and the show business, and a lot of the articles are about that, more than I feel obliged to read. The poetry, a little known, a little observed fact, is that more poetry has appeared under her editorship than appeared under Gottlieb or Sean, who had gotten the poems down to about one an issue, and she runs three or so. Fiction, which is what I cared about and which supported me for a number of years. Some of the fiction is very good, but it certainly doesn't have the kind of billing it did. It appears toward the back instead of in the front, and that is slightly hurtful to a fiction writer, but probably a fair reflection of the general run of interest among readers. Many magazines have ceased to run fiction entirely, and many that did used to run a lot of it have folded. I think, what else can I say? A lot of the staff is the same. You still get, when you have something accepted, you still get the same scrupulous editing and care and fact-checking. In many ways, it's the same worthy magazine. For all of the things you might say adverse about the shape it's taken, to me, it's still the magazine I most like to appear in, and I think it's still probably the best weekly in the country.
I had the great pleasure of reading the Rabbit series during the summer, and I had no idea that I was going to have the great pleasure of hearing you speak tonight. My question is this. I thought it was quite ironic that Harry Angstrom had absolutely no interest in reading, and even though he came from the middle class, and you write about the middle class, there, in some way, are two middle classes. There's the educated middle class and the uneducated middle class. And having come from the educated middle class, which is why I'm here. I'm very curious. How do you think the Rabbit series would have changed if you would have wrote about people in the educated middle class?
Well, he's somewhat educated. He has a high school degree and watches TV a lot and takes quite a lively interest in the culture around him. In a way, he's more alert to little currents, the little things that change, the appearance of skateboards, say, on the pavements of America, the way the women, girls dress, all that. He's very aware of it and a great student of the three-dimensional world. The fact that he doesn't read novels, I don't think makes him necessarily inferior in moral conduct or anything else to those that do. There have been people who read novels who nevertheless behaved rather badly. And stupidly. But you're right, I didn't want to write about culturally alert New Yorker. If I'd done that, I would have stayed in New York and written about them. I was trying to write about people who exist in the society and certainly are alert to it, but don't have the insulating irony of a literary approach. I myself do, unfortunately, and in some way it numbs you. It gives you a shield against the running reality that Rabbit. So when I found that when I sat down as him in his head, suddenly America came alive for me in a way it didn't actually. So I would argue that he is not to be looked down upon, but in some way taken as representative, intelligent, but not book-reading kind of person.
Mr. Updike, as far as I know, your only novel to be made into a movie was The Witches of Eastwick. And I was interested in what that experience was like for you as a writer to have such a tangible interpretation of your work to be presented to the masses. And as a follow-up to that, there seems to be more of a trend in books being made into movies. Is that something you would recommend to another author as being a positive or fulfilling experience, or something that's really slated for disappointment and regret?
A book doesn't easily translate into the cinematic form. A book thrives upon a voice and also being able, in a way, to explore nuances and ambiguities of behavior. Or so I at least feel the novel. That's what it can do best, is it can entertain several views at once and open you up to new possibilities, to new thoughts. Movies, for all of the brilliance and the power of the imagery, basically you like to know what the score is, and there's not much room for this kind of ambiguity. So I think it's a rare literary book that is fully translated into film. Usually, sometimes the film is better than the book. I thought that The English Patient was a better movie than it was a book. It actually had to clarify certain things that the book could leave vague. Movie makers have to provide the scenery, right? And they have to make decisions in a way an author doesn't. So I would, any author who gets a movie offer, by all means take it. I mean, there's some money in it, not as much as people imagine, nowhere near as much as the star gets or even the director, but there's a little money in it. And if you have a very shrewd agent, there might be a fair amount of money in it. There also, it excites interest in you as an author and in the book itself. When the movie came out, Witches of Eastwick suddenly reappeared on the paperback bestseller list, for example, and that almost invariably happens. But as far as artistic satisfaction, I can't say there's much for it. I've seen... another full-length movie was made of Rabbit Run, and it failed. It as the hero James Caan said, Rabbit Run wasn't released, it escaped. And the odd thing and the embarrassing thing to me as the writer is that it was quite faithful to the book. I sat there, and it was like seeing your pages turned into actors and scenery. For example, Rabbit's apartment, which he occupied with Janice, pretty cloudy in my mind, but they went out and they found all the right furniture that a 50s young married who had an athletic past would have. And so all that was admirable, and many of the performances were terrific. Carrie Snodgrass was lovely, and James Caan, though he seemed a little stocky, nevertheless, acted very well. So it was just that whatever the book communicated to a reader wasn't getting through to the moviegoer at all. Different language, different thing. And in general, when I see something adapted, there have been a couple TV adaptations of short stories too, and my feeling always is of shame and remorse that I've put these talented people, plus these bankers who have underwritten this enterprise, put them in a kind of a box, a little box of my imagining. cost me nothing after all, a few sheets of paper. The overhead of being a writer is very small. And a vision of something that's made up, you know, and suddenly they're trying to make something marketable and real and big and bright and gripping out of it. I feel badly for them. So I'm not sorry in that sense that so few of my books have been made into movies. A good book, as I say, resists being turned into a movie.
John Updike recorded last month at the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of their series Rebuilding the Future. Updike has a new novel. It's called Toward the End of Time. Our thanks to Richard Lippin, Elliot Shellcrott, and the staff of the Free Library of Philadelphia. Our recording engineers were Chris Fraley and Fred Snyder. Coming up, a new CD paying tribute to Jimmy Rogers. This is Fresh Air. The first release on Bob Dylan's new label, Egyptian Records, is the songs of Jimmy Rogers, a tribute. The man frequently called the father of country music is saluted here with cover versions by performers including Iris DeMent, Aaron Neville, Jerry Garcia, Bono, and Dylan himself. Before we hear Ken Tucker's review, here's Jimmy Rogers' Waiting for a Train, performed by Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers Band.
In his liner notes to this collection, Bob Dylan calls Jimmy Rogers, quote, a performer of force without precedent, with a sound as mystical as it was dynamic. To the people who loved his music in the 20s and 30s, however, lots of Rogers' music just seems darn catchy. Take, for example, this easy-rolling tune, Peach Pickin' Time Down in Georgia, cut in 1932.
When it's peach pickin' time in Georgia, apple picking time in Tennessee, cotton picking time in Mississippi, everybody picks on me. When it's roundup time in Texas, the cowboys make whoopee. Then down in old Alabama, it's gal picking time to me.
Compare that performance with a new one on the Jimmy Rogers tribute album by Willie Nelson.
When it's peach picking time in Georgia, apple picking time in Tennessee, cotton picking time in Mississippi, everybody picks on me. And when it's roundup time in Texas, the cowboys make whoopee. Then down in old Alabama, it's gal picking time for me.
Willie Nelson captures the jaunty insouciance of Rogers' song very well, I think. Rogers himself was a curious phenomenon. That father of country music label has always struck me as a bit disingenuous, since in his lifetime, Rogers strove to distinguish himself from what was then commonly called hillbilly music. and he managed to sell his songs of lonesome train rides and long-lost love as pop music as often as it was considered country. Then, too, despite his enormous influence, he wasn't really all that popular. Rodgers was really a star only in the South. None of which is to take anything away from his immensely charming music, as can be heard on Iris DeMent's beautifully plangent version of Hobo Bill's Last Ride.
Riding eastbound freight train, stealing through the night. He was just a lonesome hobo who was fighting for his life. The sadness in his eyes revealed the torture of his soul as he raised a weak and weary hand to brush away the cold.
Early reviews of the songs of Jimmie Rodgers have heaped scorn on Bob Dylan's own contribution to the tribute, a shambling, lugubriously sentimental version of My Blue-Eyed Jane. I gotta say, though, I love it.
The sweetest girl in the world is my blue-eyed Jane. We fell in love like turtle doves while the moon was shining down. I asked her then, I asked her when, the wedding bells would ring. She said, oh dear, it seems so queer that this could happen here. You are my little pal, and I've never known a sweeter gal. My blue-eyed Jane, I love you so. And when the sun goes down and the shadows are creeping all over town, just meet me in the lane, my blue-eyed Jane.
You can hear in that performance just what Bob Dylan responds to in Jimmie Rodgers' music, the way its naked emotions are clothed in the simple garments of hopefulness and slyness, along with a kind of willed innocence. Dylan doesn't yodel nearly as well as Rodgers could, but he and most of the contributors here get the soul of the music just right.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Songs of Jimmie Rodgers, a tribute. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, the moonlight so bright makes me lonely tonight. Everything seems to make me feel blue, dear. I am downhearted now. I am lonesome somehow. Cause you're proving you're untrue to me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.